This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Brait Blanks. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Brait Blanks. Across the United States, healthcare barriers like lack of insurance and long drives to facilities can create further complications for rural Americans with chronic disease and disability. As KTTZ's Samantha Larned reports, Texas Tech and Texas A&M universities are working together to increase access in some of these communities by providing telehealth services in local clinics.
In April, the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and Texas A&M University Health Sciences Center hosted a tour of their latest collaboration, a clinic built in a retrofitted shipping container in rural Burton, Texas. The partnership between the two schools began last year with another container clinic in Fort Davis. Each of the clinics are operated by community members, with primary health services provided by Texas Tech physicians and behavioral health by Texas A&M Health through telehealth. There's no insurance necessary, and patients pay a flat rate of $30 for telehealth services. Dr. Cole Johnson was recently appointed as the Chief Operating Officer of TTUHSC, and for the past year, he has served as the Senior Vice President of the Center's Division of Rural Affairs. He says the clinics are a great example of the ingenuity and collaboration it takes to bring healthcare solutions to rural areas.
If you look up the Department of State Health Services data by physician licensure, there's 40 counties in Texas as of the 2025 data that do not have a licensed primary care provider. I think that's where this desire and really mission-driven focus comes from, is knowing that there's a need and knowing that we have the capabilities to help address that need.
Johnson says TTUHSC established the model for these community-based clinics through a project in Marathon. Marathon is a census-designated place in the Big Bend region with a population of about 400. Danielle Gallo is the board president of the Marathon Health Center. She says the original clinic in the building opened in 1995, but keeping operations proved challenging.
There's really no way to financially support a traditional clinic model in a town the size of Marathon. It just doesn't work. You can't make money. You can't even really break even. So over and over and over again, we would just lose our contract and have to start over from scratch.
The primary medical center for the region is about 30 miles away in Alpine, but it can be difficult to schedule appointments, which can be especially challenging for those with chronic conditions and those without insurance. According to the U.S. Census, Marathon has a disabled population of almost 32% and an uninsured rate of almost 22%. After losing yet another contract in 2017, the president of the clinic board at the time started looking into telemedicine options and reached out to Texas Tech as a collaborator.
I like to think of it as we beat our heads against the brick wall to create a doorway for the people who came behind us, and we're very proud and happy to have done that.
Today, the nonprofit clinic has two full-time employees, yoga classes, traveling practitioners, a licensed professional counselor who comes in once a week, and does not charge for tests and lab orders or nurse visits.
It's very scalable. Like, it can be as small as a janitor's closet with internet access and a blood pressure cuff and a scale, or it can be as big as a facility like ours that has multiple exam rooms and a community room and offices.
A janitor's closet, or a shipping container. The Davis Mountain Clinic in Jeff Davis County was the first collaboration between Texas A&M and Texas Tech Health Sciences Centers. Carol Brewer is a registered nurse, the clinic's executive director, and its only employee.
There's no clinic in this area. The closest one is about 25 miles away in Alpine. So this just provides a local resource so they don't have to drive so far through the mountains.
She says she gets a lot of drop-ins of people coming in with general questions. She even makes home visits for people who can't come to the clinic in person. Over in Burton, a small city with a population of about 300 people, Mark Rosenbaum is a paramedic lieutenant at Washington County EMS and a registered nurse. He has worked in emergency medical services for about 15 years and has spent his whole career in rural areas. He says that whether it's 15 miles or 100 to the nearest doctor's office, it doesn't make much of a difference for those who don't have transportation.
There have been multiple times we've taken people to the hospital via ambulance because that's, quite frankly, the only way they can get into town to go see a physician. So a lot of these people don't even have primary care.
A local ministry, Burton Bridge Ministry, had been looking into ways to bring a clinic to the community for years, and Rosenbaum says it joined with Washington County EMS to try to find a partner to provide telehealth care. Eventually, they found Texas A&M Health and TTUHSC. The in-person services at Burton Southern Clinic will be provided by paramedics.
they're the ones that are actively going out and seeing people, trying to do preventative care in the community. So we're going to use those guys to staff it. So we'll be the hands and eyes and the ears of the physician. The eyes and the ears get replaced by the telemedicine equipment.
Dr. Johnson with the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center says this kind of community-based care can help improve health outcomes for a population. A 2021 data brief from the National Center for Health Statistics found that in 2019, rural areas had a 20% higher death rate than urban areas, even when accounting for different age demographics.
Healthcare is sort of staked and anchored in your community. I think it changes the community's perception of how they perceive and embrace healthcare as part of the fabric of the community.
In Fort Davis, Carol Brewer is seeing those changes firsthand.
There's people out here that they've told me they do not know what they would have done if we hadn't been here. And it's just saving them time and money and stress, providing things that are so easy for people that live in urban areas to access to the people in this area is going to make for a healthier population.
In Lubbock, I'm Samantha Larned.
Yeti, the popular brand that makes metal insulated tumblers and rugged coolers geared towards hunters and fishermen, is based in Texas. A focus of its marketing is on sustainability, even honoring Big Bend National Park in one of its drinkware collections. The Big Bend region is at the center of a border security and environmentalist clash as the federal government's plans to build a border wall in the area take shape. A new report from Marfa Public Radio outlines the connection of one of Yeti's co-founders and a ranch helping with the wall's construction. Marfa Public Radio's Mary Cantrell spoke with Jerry Quijano of KUT's Austin Signal about the reporting.
So can you tell us, out there in Marfa, what's it been like as these plans for the border wall have been taking shape, and how has that been for folks out there in West Texas?
It has been a wild ride following this story. We've been reporting on this pretty much nonstop since February. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is moving pretty fast on this project. Plans are ever-changing, and there's virtually no public oversight or public involvement on the project. And since plans came out that they were intending to build walls in this area, which has never seen walls before, there's been pretty bipartisan, widespread opposition to the idea, considering we have low traffic in the region, and we're pretty proud of our, you know, state and national parks, which are preserved. So, yeah, it's been quite the story.
Can you tell us a little bit about who is Ryan Cedars?
So Ryan Cedars is one of the co-founders of the brand Yeti, which, as you noted, is well known for their coolers and drinkware products. They're headquartered right there in Austin. Ryan co-founded the company in 2006 with his brother, and since then the company has grown into a publicly traded billion-dollar enterprise.
And the Yeti brand has leaned into sustainability as part of its tenets, correct?
Yes, that's correct. They emphasize a focus on renewable energy and sustainability in terms of the life cycle of their products. And being a primarily outdoor lifestyle brand, of course, there is an overall focus on a love and stewardship of the outdoors, you know, getting outside and appreciating the environment.
Going back to the construction of the wall, what have experts been saying about its possible environmental impacts?
Yes. So a border wall is anticipated to have a broad range of environmental impacts to the Rio Grande Corridor. Like I said, we don't have any border walls out here for the large part. We're talking about, in some places, a 30-foot high steel wall along the river with patrol roads, lighting, technology, just a massive border security suddenly, you know, coming down on the river corridor. Environmental advocates have voiced concerns about impacts to wildlife migration, black bears, mountain lions. We have an international dark sky reserve, which they're, you know, worried could be threatened by more lighting and more technology. And of course, there's a lot of rich archaeological sites along the river. This is a long inhabited place. So not only are there environmental concerns, there's archaeological concerns. And, you know, we have flash flooding in the region. When it rains, it can be really, you know, the corridors surge with water. And so there's a concern about, well, how is this wall going to impact flooding in the region, and could it put people at risk?
So tell us a little bit about this ranch up in West Texas and how it's affiliated with Ryan Cedars.
Right. So Ryan Cedars is one of three owners of this ranch, according to public documents that we obtained. This is a large ranch that crosses multiple counties, Hudspeth, Jeff Davis, and Presidio counties in far West Texas. And they have about 12 to 15 miles of border frontage along the Rio Grande. So in terms of border wall building, you know, 12 to 15 mile chunk is pretty significant for contractors. The ranch is also strategically located at the end of one of the only roads in the area that leads toward to the border called Chispa Road. And that road has been identified by contractors as, you know, a key thoroughfare to help them get the equipment and get the crews they need down to the border to see this project to fruition. So, yeah, that's the connection.
And I know you reached out to Cedars and Yeti. What did they have to say about this?
They have not responded to our requests for comments so far. You know, we're still open to hearing from them. So, yeah, we'll see, but nothing yet.
Well, this has been a story that's been going back and forth and back and forth. What comes next for the Big Bend area and the border wall there?
So construction is slated to get underway, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, in late summer or early fall. We are seeing steel wall panels already moving in to staging sites. Man camps are being set up. So, you know, billions of dollars have been awarded to see this project to fruition to, you know, primarily two firms, one of which is based out of Montana. And so they're gearing up full steam ahead for the project to try to see it through.
All right. We've been speaking with Mary Cantrell. She is a reporter with Marfa Public Radio. Mary, thank you for your time.
Of course. Thanks so much.
And while Yeti did not respond to Marfa Public Radio's request for comment, a spokesperson did offer this comment to the Austin American-Statesman, quote, Yeti Holdings does not have any involvement or ownership in Moody Bennett Ranch or Trans Pecos Ice LLC, end quote.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm your host, Brad Blanks. As the push for AI data centers ramps up, so does the need for electricity to power them. And officials are looking at all options to ensure that there's enough for the data centers and everyone else. The United States is the world's largest producer of nuclear power, generating nearly 30% of global nuclear electricity. Texas is a key producer for not only oil and gas, but for wind power, and state officials are moving to increase nuclear power output. Jason Isaac is CEO of the American Energy Institute and served in the Texas State House between 2011 and 2019, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Jason.
It's great to be on, Bray. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's start by getting your view of the kind of short to medium term need for electricity in the U.S. And then can you kind of put it into simple terms how much you think this AI boom is going to impact that?
There's certainly a big need for new electric generation, reliable electric generation from nuclear, natural gas, and coal right now. We're seeing fluctuations during peak demand where a significant portion of the grid doesn't perform. That's namely wind and solar. And I've been doing some research and looking over the last years of these peak demand times. And granted, wind and solar are providing a significant portion of the amount of electricity. It's just during those peak demand times where they vary so much. You look at the highest demand day of the year so far, January 24th, in that highest demand hour at 6 p.m., and solar was providing 0% of its installed capacity. Natural gas, coal, and nuclear were all above 70% of their installed capacity, keeping the lights and the heat on. And here in the U.S., we really haven't seen any new nuclear in about 10 years. So there is a big push. I know I heard Governor Abbott say last year at an event that he wants Texas to lead and be the leader of the nuclear renaissance. I think we're going to be competing with Tennessee on those regards. But I do see both of those states, you know, Texas and Tennessee, playing a key role in the advancement of nuclear provided electricity, as well as some medical advancements for something that was shocking to me when I learned this a few years ago.
Yeah, we're actually going to talk about that in a recent op-ed. You know, you wrote about the side benefits of that new nuclear plant near Austin, and then ACU's next lab right here in Abilene also going to be producing those medical isotopes you referenced. So these new reactors are not generating the type of waste that they did historically, and they are creating this byproduct that's a benefit in the medical industry. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about that for us?
Yeah, really. I learned about it first there in Abilene at Natura Resources facility. They're building the nation's first generation 4 liquid fueled molten salt reactor, and they're doing so on the Abilene Christian University campus. I've had the opportunity to tour that a couple of times. And that's where I first learned about medical isotopes and how you use these medical isotopes. It's a product of nuclear reactions. I don't understand the science and the physics and the math of it very well, but I do know that you actually use these medical isotopes to treat cancer and to really kill the cancer rather than the healthy cells like chemotherapy does. And this is something that's, you know, it's an emotional issue to me, having had family members that we've lost because of cancer. And knowing that the cure for cancer is going to be coming out of Texas at places like the Natura Resources facility in Abilene Christian University and then Oklo's facility in Lockhart, Texas, which will reach criticality before July 4th of this year. So within the next few weeks, the Oklo facility in Lockhart, Texas, which was in the district I served during my first legislative term, I was so excited, just southeast of Austin, they'll be producing medical isotopes, and that's their big target there. We import a lot of them now for treatment of cancer and other medical issues, and they have a short shelf life. It's my understanding that between 24 and 48 hours is all these medical isotopes last for. And so to be producing them here in the United States, we're really going to be the key leader on the nuclear renaissance and continue our leadership in Texas for fighting cancer.
Absolutely. Some groundbreaking, and as you mentioned, possibilities on the horizon with all this nuclear output. You referenced Governor Abbott earlier. He actually issued a call to slow down on AI data centers, in large part because of his concern about, you know, overtaxing the state's grid. What is the reality of nuclear power making a big dent in that, a significant difference? And then how long do you think it's going to take to get us there?
Yeah, I think in the short term, those data centers are going to be powered by on-site natural gas, electric fired generation, which many of them are already doing off-grid right now, so not impacting ratepayers and consumers. And then I think you're still several years, probably 5 to 7 away before you have some of these small modular reactors. I know Dow has a facility and a project going on in Seadrift, Texas. It's a 4-reactor, small modular reactor project. So that's really going to be these tiny, if you say tiny, basically truckload size generators that are small modular reactors that provide constant electricity. And there's already contracts in place. A company, Liberty Energy, is providing on-site electric generation now powered by natural gas. And then with the plans is they have investments in nuclear technology. They'll switch that over to a small modular reactor in several years. But ultimately, they will be powered by nuclear electricity.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about production and output, that Texas is not yet one of the biggest players in this sector, but most of the major producers. Can you kind of tell us where they are in the U.S. and what you see that they're doing that we might start doing as well?
I think Oklo, another company I've mentioned before, has an agreement in Tennessee to recycle this Cold War era plutonium, which still has a lot of energy potential. This is something that we were doing up until the Carter administration. We stopped recycling spent fuel rods in this plutonium, this Cold War era plutonium. Leaving Russia and France as the only countries on the planet that are recycling this fuel. And we have restarted that process. This is an incredible announcement. There's still a lot of fuel in those rods. You recycle that, you re-enrich it, and you get to continue their life. And that cuts down on the waste. And that's one of the things, because you look across the United States right now, states like Florida, they're just storing this. States like Texas, we have it here in Texas. We're just holding these spent fuel rods in cooling areas at the nuclear facilities on site now. So we'll have some work to do legislatively in Texas to allow for the transportation of this, to get them to recycling facilities, because all of that was really locked down. I believe it was 2019 and 2021 legislative sessions banning the transportation of any of this nuclear fuel, the spent fuel, out of concerns for safety. I think people are starting to learn a little bit more about it, that nuclear is the safest, most dense fuel on the planet, and that we need to be using more of it, certainly not less. And so I'm really excited about what's going on in Tennessee and here in Texas. And then you've got Three Mile Island that Microsoft has partnered with, that wants to take this completely back online and may have that back online within a matter of 2 years, providing electricity for their data centers and actually for consumers in the Northeast United States. So that'll be good for ratepayers up in the Northeast that are paying some of the highest electricity costs in the United States.
Yes, I'm sure they are looking forward to a break themselves. You referenced Three Mile Island, of course, the historic, a difficult time for people that had to deal with that in 1979. Can you talk a little bit about the concerns that people might have that aren't aware of all the safety precautions that are going into nuclear power generation right now?
Yeah, and I think this is something I've actually, having toured nuclear facilities, not only up and coming ones like at Nutora, but other nuclear generation electricity facilities here in Texas, and realizing how safe and secure they are. And you look at what happened at Three Mile Island, no loss of life at that particular, but it is quite alarming still when you have issues. You look at what happened in Fukushima in Japan, no loss of life there except in the evacuation. People lost their lives in traffic accidents. And then you look at Chernobyl, which is really poor construction, still no loss of life from immediately at firefighters that lost their lives. But that comes back to really poor construction, something that we don't have here in the United States. So I think that's why public perception has changed so much over the last few years. It was 5 decades ago. There was this big movement against nuclear energy, people concerned about fallouts and meltdowns. And you look at Natura, it's a molten salt reactor. If there is something that happens, then that molten salt that's a liquid just turns into a solid salt, incredibly safe. And I think, again, that's why public perception has changed so much over just the last decade. People overwhelmingly oppose nuclear energy, and now they're overwhelmingly supporting it. So I think it's just people getting more information about the safety and security of it that are gaining the confidence and want it, really powering the electricity in their state. It does provide incredible base load electric generation, which is this constant flow of electricity onto our grid. You look at our nuclear installed capacity here in Texas, and it's only about 5 gigawatts of electricity, very small amount, but it is constantly putting that continuous amount of electricity around the clock for Texas consumers. And that really helps with the management of our grid.
Lots of exciting things on the horizon. Jason, thank you so much for your insight today. Jason Isaac, CEO of American Energy Institute and former Texas State Representative.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. Every spring, peach lovers from all over Texas descend upon the Hill Country. The area around Fredericksburg is famous for its peaches, and they're best enjoyed as close to harvest as possible. In recent years, though, the peaches have been harder to get your hands on due to a series of small crops. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
At their farm stand outside Fredericksburg, Eckhart Orchards has all kinds of local produce for sale. Watermelons, squash, jalapenos, tomatoes, but the peaches are the big draw.
I've been coming here since I was a little girl to Fredericksburg to buy peaches.
That's Marlene Russell. She drove 100 miles from her home in Fort McCavitt on a clear Thursday morning to get Fredericksburg peaches. She likes to stock up so she can eat some, freeze some, and make cobblers too.
If it's a big crop, sometimes I make 3 or 4 trips down here.
But it's not a big peach crop in the Hill Country this year. In a kitchen that smells like coleslaw and cobbler attached to the farm stand, Diane Eckhart says the small harvest is due to a warm winter.
The piece that we were lacking this year to have a full crop was the cold hours, the chill hours. We were marginal on them.
Diane is part of the third generation of Eckharts to grow peaches in the Hill Country. After the first frost of winter, she and other growers start counting chill hours, generally defined as time between 45 and 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Particularly January and February is when we get the majority of our colds. We want those nice, cloudy January and February days.
Too few chill hours in the winter means the tree won't bear much fruit in the spring.
So that's been the big struggle the last 3 years is, we just haven't had the cold weather.
That's Larry Stein, professor and horticulturalist for the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service. He's been studying Texas peaches for 40 years. Stein says that year after year of minimal chill can stress trees long term. It can impact fruit quality as well as quantity.
Low chill peaches are elongated and they don't necessarily develop full quality like a typical peach would.
The Hill Country became a peach mecca because it has the right soil and climate. The winters were cold enough without freezing too frequently. A layer of clay under a sandy loam helped carry the trees through droughts. Earlier, growers could rely solely on rainfall to water their trees. That's harder to do now with drier weather. Eckhart Orchards now irrigates some of their crops to supplement rainfall. Behind the stand in a small orchard, Diane points out trees with skimpy branches.
This is a variety that did not set real well this year. This is Dixieland. So there's not a whole lot of fruit on these trees.
Eckhart has some peaches for sale. Availability will vary as different varieties ripen throughout the summer. The day I was there, you could buy an eighth of a bushel, about 6 pounds, of Crimson Lady peaches for $29. Drought and warmer winters may make it harder to grow peaches, but Eckhart has no plans to stop.
For my generation, I was gifted with it. I didn't have to buy this land, and it's a gift that it grows wonderful things. So that just, like, you can't ignore that. You kind of feel like you gotta do what the land does best, you know?
She's going to plant some new crops for the fall in order to make up for the small peach harvest, including pumpkins, okra, and blackberries. I'm Michael Marks.
Our friends at the Texas Standard are asking for help building a list of the top 250 songs about Texas or by Texas musicians. It's part of their celebration of America's 250th birthday. Here's the latest installment of the series looking at key moments in the Lone Star State's rich music history.
I'm Matt Riley from KUTX, and as we look towards the 250th birthday of the United States, we're celebrating with the Texas 250, the Lone Star State's contribution to American music. Here's a moment when Texas music had the world's attention. March 1987. What was expected to be a regional event with a couple of hundred attendees quickly became a national and then eventually global event. South by Southwest was originally a modest music festival and conference in Austin that grew into an international destination for not just music, but film, tech, politics, and occasionally controversy. Initially envisioned as an extension of the New York City Music Festival New Music Seminar, that idea was quickly abandoned, and Austinites Roland Swenson, Louis Black, Nick Barbaro, and Louis J. Myers created their own vision. Ah! 1994 was the first turning point for South by Southwest, with Johnny Cash as keynote speaker and performer, and the festival expanding into film and new technologies. The aughts and 20-teens brought a further explosion of attention to the once humble Austin Music Festival. The exponential growth of the fest mirrored Austin's own rise, and it is easily argued that the two are intertwined. Many consider 2014 another turning point for the festival. Lady Gaga was the keynote speaker, and her collaboration with Doritos on a vending machine-shaped stage proved a bridge too far for many festival-goers and Austinites. Additionally, a drunk driver struck and killed 4 festival pedestrians in the Red River District, changing the future layout and permitting of the festival. South by Southwest wasn't immune to the effects of COVID-19 either, creating a reset of the entire festival. It continues to be an economic driver for Austin and a space for global conversation around music, film, and technology today. You can see more about this moment at texasstandard.org/Texas250. And we want to hear from you. We're counting down the 250 essential Texas songs July 3rd and 4th on KUTX, and you can cast your vote for your favorite Texas song at texasstandard.org/Texas250.
It's time for West Texas Roots. Everyone loves a good chicken fry, and in 1883, the citizens of Buffalo Gap were no different. Sean Ward explains the folklore of how the Taylor County seat was moved from Buffalo Gap to Abilene, and after the county seat was moved, the citizens of Buffalo Gap threw the mayor a chicken fry using his own chickens. And Abilene resident Mr. Scott tells of how his ancestor escaped death when he picked the right bean during the Texas Revolution.
Buffalo Gap was the county seat, and there was the big debate on whether it was going to get moved to Abilene or not, so everybody voted on that. Well, the story is the mayor of Buffalo Gap was a chicken farmer, and he voted against the town people to move it to Abilene and not have it stay in Buffalo Gap. Well, when the vote finally happened and they were going to move it to Abilene, they threw a big town party, you know, congratulations, blah, 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 and they served fried chicken. The story is it was the mayor's chickens the townspeople cooked up for his celebration dinner. Well, I mean, not that it really matters. I mean, the railroad goes right through Buffalo Gap. It goes right through Tuscola. The whole area could have been any part of the county seat, but since Abilene was growing exponentially and Buffalo Gap wasn't, that's why they wanted to move it, the county seat to Abilene. But that's the story. They served him up his own chickens. I am from Abilene originally. I was born and raised here in Abilene, but through my younger years, 40 years ago. Anyways, I stomped around all over this area. I had a ton of friends out in Buffalo Gap, Tuscola. I had family in Clyde, Bear. I mean, I was everywhere.
I've been in Callahan County since they settled it, you know, back in the 1800s and all like that. On my mom's side of the family, they settled it in Callahan County and have one ancestor who was in the Goliad massacre, you know. He's Big John Scott. He survived it. He drew one of the beans and he survived it. But then it takes the history books and stuff like that. This is 1800s. It was with the Alamo, you know, when they attacked the Alamo, they also did a little town called Goliad. Yes, you know, and they captured, Travis or something like that, his name. And so they had everybody draw beans, and the one that drew the black bean survived, and he's the one that drew one of the black beans, so he survived.
We recorded Sean Ward's story of how the mayor of Buffalo Gap chickens became lunch and Mr. Scott's story of his Texas Revolutionary ancestor at the Taylor County Expo Center. If you've got a story to share, whether it's a personal memory, family lore, or the story of a community member, let us know. We would love to hear it. Reach out to us by emailing us at info@kacu.org. Use the subject line West Texas Roots. We know there are hundreds of West Texas stories out there just waiting to be told. This is the West Texas Dispatch. An exhibit at the Grace Museum features the work of memory painters. These paintings are the work of artists who were not classically trained in the fine arts, and they're often described as folk or outsider artists. The works aim to tell stories that help the artist relive or retell moments from their lives. The Grace is partnering with KACU to host Memory Night tomorrow, June 18th. Visitors will be invited not only to enjoy the Memory Painter's exhibit, but to share the stories that fill their memories for our West Texas Roots Oral History Project. KACU's Allison Diaz spoke with Erica Rodriguez, Public Programs Coordinator for the Grace Museum, to discuss the event.
Talk to me a little bit about Memory Night and Mosaic Moments.
Memory Night is tied to our Memory Painters exhibition, which is on the second floor. And what's really special about that exhibition in particular is it's a mix of different artists. And these were all artists that had no classical training. And so they were using art as a form of storytelling. And, you know, when you look at them, they're capturing themes of family and worship and different things like that that are more things that we would see or experience on a regular basis. And so we just wanted to have a night where we could invite visitors to come and see it, and they could go and share whatever they're inspired or whatever the exhibition kind of brings up in their own personal lives.
The painters of the original paintings, tell me a little bit about them specifically.
So the painters are really cool. Like I said, they are a variety. So it's a different group of different ones. Ones that we kind of highlighted are Clara McDonald Williamson. And she's a primitive artist in Texas from the mid-20th century. She began painting when she was 68 years old, so that's really cool. And the other one that we've kind of highlighted is Dilmorth Paramore. And he briefly studied art as a child, but what's also really special about him is that his hometown is here in Abilene, so that's really cool. But yeah, it's just something that I think this type of art exhibition is very approachable. And like I said, it just, you look at them and you remember kind of seeing something very similar in your own memories of something that you've experienced before. So it's really easy to connect with. And a lot of people have really enjoyed it, even little kids. So it's something that all ages would enjoy.
Tell me what has gone into planning this night specifically and what you expect and what the goal of the night is as a whole.
I think the main goal is, like I said before, is we just want to encourage people to connect with what's on the wall. We want art to be approachable and not be so intimidating. And we just want to highlight the themes that the artists themselves were highlighting. And hopefully through KACU and having this memory night, we'll be able to bridge those two things together of what you guys want to do with your oral history project and what we want to do of making art more approachable, and hopefully come out with a product that's really nice and that people will enjoy. And who doesn't love going down memory lane and talking about their childhood?
Yeah. So Mosaic Moments, that is the exhibit of all of the paintings, or talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the exhibit name is Memory Painters. Mosaic Moments is our senior program. And so this is just a special event that we're doing for the program, but we're more than happy to have anyone that wants to participate. That'd be great. Mosaic Moments is something that we have been doing for a while, and I just started taking it over. We do different things very similar to what Memory Night is, of just inviting people to come see one particular exhibit. We'll have them come up to the classroom and they'll do a craft that's based loosely sometimes on what they just saw. If they're not either in the classroom, they'll be doing art in the galleries themselves. So it's just kind of providing a space for an older audience to come and enjoy something more peaceful in the morning and to just kind of tap into their creative skills. Even if they don't have any, they're more than welcome to come.
Okay, so this event is just like a highlighted event for them specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, but like I said, anyone is welcome. And we would love, and I'm sure you would echo the same, we would love anyone to participate, sharing their memories.
What has been something that you have seen or heard from the seniors who are involved in this Mosaic Moments project? What has been the thing that's most encouraging for you to hear, or something that you feel like really drives you forward regarding like the impact of it?
I think what really drives me forward is just seeing that there's an interest, people coming, and even if it's just one person, them being interested in what we're doing and what we're offering. But just in general, I think just seeing the public be able to connect with something on the wall and kind of pointing it out to me and saying, hey, this is my favorite, because I also do tours. That's something that's really special, of just seeing, especially like a younger audience, just anyone really that isn't really into art, seeing them find something on the wall that they really like and them being so excited about it that they point it out is something that's really special, and it makes me happy. Yeah. And it makes me realize why I wanted to do this in the first place.
Well, thank you, Erica.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's KACU's arts and culture reporter Allison Diaz speaking with Erica Rodriguez, public programs coordinator for the Grace Museum. Memory Night at the Grace is set for tomorrow, 5 to 8 p.m. We would love to hear your stories of living in the West Texas area for KACU's West Texas Roots. These can be family lore, individual memories, or as we said, even unique events in a community's history. We hope to see you there. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We are here every Wednesday at noon, so be sure to tune in for the best news from West Texas. And you can always subscribe to the West Texas Dispatch podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Bray Blanks.